Hello, and welcome to Season 8 of the Canadian Women's Foundation podcast, All Right, Now What? Gender equality and justice, where we live, work, learn, and play, is the goal, and it makes life better for everyone. All Right, Now What? Remains a space where we ask, how do we move from awareness to action? But this season, we're also shifting the story. Through powerful storytelling, expert interviews, and bold conversations, we'll explore what true equity can look like, especially for those who are too often silenced or overlooked. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and its partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Inuit, and Métis territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.
Hi, I'm Shagane Hampram from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Today, we're joined by award-winning journalist, author, and speaker, Angela Sterrett. In our conversation, Angela shares how her time working in Vancouver's community radio scene shaped her path into journalism and storytelling. We talk about what makes stories powerful in Indigenous traditions, not just the message, but the way a story is carried and what happens when narratives are distorted to serve power. Angela also shares the heart behind her books, including how her reporting on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls pushed her to connect personal experience to the larger architecture of colonial violence, and why compassion and accountability have to travel together. Well, hello again, Angela. So I went to Calgary for the first time in September. The Canadian Women's Foundation was doing an event with Generation Women Canada, and it was about generational storytelling and trying to bring it. So you have someone from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I think it's a beautiful, powerful format that we wanted to bring to Calgary for the first time. And so because I had a few days there and I was there on Orange Shirt Day and Truth and Reconciliation, I was looking up events, saw that you're speaking at UCalgary, and I brought a few colleagues with me, and I was so glad that I went. We all left. I wish I had blocked more time, because it literally was going to hearing your keynote and then having to run off. And I was like, I need to process so much of what you said. It was so powerful. And I've kind of become obsessed. I've been looking you up. I've been reading your book. So for me, this is really an honor that you would take the time to come on and share a bit about your story and about your work, which I think is much needed and very important. So that's how I came to know you. And, I mentioned I read your book, and I really want to dive into how powerful it is, how important that conversation is. But I want to take a step back and talk a little bit about your journey getting to where you are now, because you are an award-winning investigative journalist. You're a TV podcast radio host and, of course, a national best-selling author. So could you share a bit about your journey into getting to where you are today?
My journey with journalism started so long ago, like just as a teenager. I think I talked about it in my keynote when I was in a group home, and I had, I don't know if we want to go into the whole story of sort of the genesis of that, but I was actually ready to take my life when a group home dad, Tom Littlewood, had accidentally came home unexpected and found my suicide note and had, you know, started knocking on the door and not telling me what I expected him to hear, which would have been easy to brush off because things weren't true. Like, we love you. You have so much to live for. None of those things were true. He knew those things weren't true. And he said, I've got your note and you're an incredible writer. And it completely threw me off course and shook me out of my process of what I was thinking in deep darkness. And he said, there's so many things you can do with this writing. You know, you could be a journalist, you could be an author, you could be a radio host. And he actually ended up taking me down to a radio station here in Vancouver that was at Pigeon Park at the time, in the downtown east side, called Co-op Radio. And being in that space just completely changed my life at imagining the possibilities. And this was an old, at the time, it's drastically different now, but at the time it was like 1950s equipment. I'm not that old, so it wasn't actually in the 50s, but the equipment was very old and kind of like war era equipment. But just seeing people talk about all these ideas, and there was, you know, an Armenian show, and that's where I ended up hosting my first radio show not too long out. Well, maybe like 6 years later, I hosted a radio show about Native youth is the word we used at the time. I still use that word, Native. We are Native to these lands in Turtle Island. But so I'll go back to the Tom Littlewood story. I didn't end up becoming a journalist right then and there. I mean, I was probably 14 years old, but it gave me a place to dream. And not long after, I was still sort of getting myself off of the street as a street kid. And I started running a show with Billy Pierre, who ran Redwire magazine at the time. And we did a radio show called Sound Options for Youth. And it was just so incredible. And the show that came before me was an Armenian show. And the Armenian guy was just so supportive and helpful. And it was just like a magical place. And I found radio magical, because not only could you help people to dream on that side of the mic, but on the other side, people get to use their imagination, right? They can't see, they can just hear. They have to imagine what you're talking about. And so there's a lot of things that happened that from there that got me to CBC in the end. But that's sort of how everything started off, which is a bit dramatic, which is a bit like me. So par for the course.
In your experience of being a storyteller, what have you found to be the most rewarding part, and what have you found to be the most challenging?
I love stories. I always tell people it's in my DNA, and I've heard that phrase used a lot since I started saying that. Well, not like people are stealing from me. That's not what I'm saying. Ideas are in the universe and ready for our taking. But when I think about, for example, giving a keynote, I'm telling a story. And you know, I tell people what makes a good story. Like, think about our traditional stories or our ancestral stories, the stories that have been shared through generation to generation. What makes them good? And I ask people that as an open-ended question. And they usually have to think about it a lot. And for me, it's the way that the story is told. It's not, and that's something that's, I guess, specific to Indigenous stories, is that, you know, the message might be something that you carry with you or not, but you always remember the way that the person shared the story and the arc of the story, the excitement of the story, the humor in the story, and all of those different energies or elements that make a really good story. So that's what I love about storytelling, and story is the way that you can tell a story and how engaging it can be, how fun it can be, how much joy and levity they can bring us. And that's something I think that's missing from our lives, right? And especially right now, there's just so much darkness, so many dark stories in the world, and sadness and despair and hopelessness. And my fiance always says, you can't lose hope, because then you're hopeless, right? We can't be that. We have to hold on to hope. And stories are stories that from way back give me a lot of hope and give me a lot of provocation of so many different things. Imagination that I was talking about earlier. I think that the challenging part about telling stories for me has been in that when we're telling truths that live within stories in today's world, the stories that I talked about that can be confronting, not everybody wants to hear those. And I talk about this in my next book, you know, the way that narratives have been switched to serve a purpose, to benefit those in power who are still gripping on to that power as if their lives depended on it, because they find that, you know, narratives are shifting and stories are shifting and who gets to tell them is shifting and how we tell those stories is shifting. I found this a lot in my research for my second book, is that a lot of the narratives that we believe, not just as a society, but Indigenous people, have really shaped how we think about who we are. And those stories, you know, have been created to suit a narrative to benefit, you know, white supremacy, white male supremacy. And it's time, I believe, to look back and realize how those stories have been altered to take power away from us. And so, I mean, I guess the hardest part of telling stories is who is telling them and who's publishing them. I found that a lot in my stories, in this research that I did, thinking about the explorer, the colonist, the imperialist, Captain Cook. The diaries that he initially published were rewritten in a completely different account, and new information was added to make Indigenous people appear as if they were savage, that they were cannibals, which was not in Cook's original diary. So there's a lot of different threads to pull apart when we think about the way stories are told and who is telling them and who is publishing them, especially historically, but even today, right? We see that in the news, the CNN and the Foxes of the world. There's a lot of deception, and that's not new. You know, all this stuff, oh, there's so much deception. That's not new. It was just differently done. It was taking a diary and rewriting that diary, hand rewriting a diary, right? So that energy has always been there. And that's sort of the darkness of storytelling for me, is the way that people can flip the narrative so that we see ourselves as something other than who we know that we are, if that makes sense at all.
Absolutely. Because it sounds like, to your point, because, you know, the stories you've been able to share, which I think are quite important and needed, are being combated with other stories that are not necessarily true. And it makes me think that in general, history is a story, right? Like, I think about growing up here in Toronto and how very much of a story I was shared with history in terms of Indigenous communities and their place in history. And then you unlearn that story. And I think there is a benefit now that there's hopefully more diverse storytelling, more people who have the option to be a storyteller, and we don't just sort of kind of control or gatekeep who gets to tell stories. And so this leads me very much to your book, Unbroken, and very powerful. It is a part memoir and part investigative journalism on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Very powerful. I felt it very much mirrored your style and your keynote, which is exactly sort of what you said, which is you're telling the truth. I think you tell the truth in such a way that is inviting. It is inviting for people to reflect and think about maybe why they didn't know what they knew, how they might have heard some of these narratives and stories before. And it was one of those, I felt this in reading this, that you couldn't, you know, just stop. Even if it's very heavy, you get, you know, very in detail to specific cases, some that I didn't even know some of the details. And you wrote in such a way that even if it feels very painful and heartbreaking to kind of read some of these stories, it almost felt like an obligation to continue, because you do realize this is an important story that everyone needs to know. And so in writing your book, when did you know that you were going to write this book? And what did you learn throughout the process? And I am curious why, and you know, you maybe have already answered this, why it did take a form as a book and not in other mediums. I would like to hear that process, because it is, I know the years you put into that book and the details and all that effort. And I want to hear about how that journey is.
I think, like, all my life, I was a really good storyteller. Like, people would always be enchanted by my stories, and they were all true. They were all my life. And, you know, I grew up on the street, so I think sometimes it's hard for people to see my story as truth, because when you're living in this, on the street, you're living in kind of a very imaginative space too. Like, I lived in many abandoned buildings, right? And just like, I lived in a bank. I think it was like the corner of Granville and Seymour. Those two might not intersect, but it was down in that area, if people know Vancouver. And you live in a very different world than everybody else, right? It took me a long time to adjust to having a bathroom inside of a house or eating at a kitchen table. And people have a hard time, I think, reckoning with that reality. But it also made like some incredible stories, some really dark, some funny, all of the things. So people were always like, you've got to write a book. You have to write a book about your life experience. And I was like, oh yeah, that'd be great. That'd be fun. And then I started writing my story. Actually, it started as fiction. And fiction, it almost feels like you need more details, right? Like I tried to avoid gratuitous details in Unbroken just to protect people and myself. But as I was writing my life story in this sort of fiction format, it just was like traumatizing. I was like, this is so intense. And my life has been really hard, which I think is important for anybody to see, because I think oftentimes, especially I think as Indigenous people, it's like, oh, I haven't had it that bad. You know, I still sometimes think that, but writing everything all out, it's like, whoa, like my life's been incredibly hard and difficult and challenging and sad. And that was hard. It was, you know, I spent many nights. I think I started it in Winnipeg. I remember the lonely nights I think I lived in the north end of Winnipeg at the time, and just a lot of, and I was a single mom. So my son was maybe 6 or something then. And I just remember like crying all the time, like curled up in a ball on the floor. And it was like so hard, traumatic. And at the same time, I was doing a lot of reporting on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And the stories were very siloed, right? So it was sort of like you have these different cases. We don't like to use the term cold cases, I guess, but there were a lot of those types of historical cases. And then there were current cases. But it was sort of all done as if like missing and murdered Indigenous women is sort of like one thing on its own. But there's a whole apparatus of empire building that created, you know, what I call a sort of like building an architecture of unsafety within Indigenous people's bodies. And that starts at residential school, that starts at the impetus of land theft, that starts at the reserve system, that starts at, you know, harrowing stories of stealing children. And so I wanted people to sort of see the full picture, what it's like to live sort of within the belly of the beast with a flashlight on or with a spotlight on, and not just see this as, you know, these are all separate things that happen. These were all created on purpose by colonials and by systems of colonial violence. And so that's when I sort of got the idea, well, maybe I don't have to tell all of these details about myself. Maybe I can show this picture and help people build compassion for Indigenous women and girls, because my book is specifically about Indigenous women and girls, mostly because it's sort of my perspective as an Indigenous woman and girl, and include myself a little bit. And myself being included, the inclusion of myself sort of became bigger and bigger with the presence of my editor and my agent, who were like, I think people will want to hear more, and this will help people anchor themselves within the larger story that you want to tell. And that compassion will grow when they sort of see it through your eyes rather than people who you're telling stories about eyes. And I think that was a really good piece of advice that I'm glad I listened to. But yeah, it was a long journey to get to where it's at. And grateful to my editor, Jennifer Kroll, for helping guide it to make it what it is today.
And I agree, because I was curious how much had started with your story and then the other stories. But I will say, reading parts of your life and then seeing sort of it zoomed out, you see connections a lot more. It instantly becomes, instead of this thing over here that you think exactly what you're saying, that is isolated or has no connection, it's the weaving of that could have been you, that could have been many other women, and it has been many other women. And even if we don't know their names and talk about them. And so there was such a power in kind of bringing that focus there. And I also could really see how much more in unweaving of your story that you could, in a way, it seemed like it was healing to also see the connection of what you were doing. Because as you were talking about, because, you know, I can imagine all our lives are normalized until sort of you have the perspective of not seeing it. And, you know, that resonated so much of it wasn't that bad. You know, I know other people have had it worse. And it sounds like, and I felt that through the page, that there was something healing about investigating these stories and what it meant for you and giving it opportunity for you to reflect on your life and seeing what that is. And I can imagine as a parent, that's even stronger because you're now raising a young Indigenous person who's going to be sort of the next generation. And actually, I was going to comment about your letter because I thought your letter to your son was very beautiful. And I could relate to that so much now raising my own son. And there's a quote that I've said to many friends after I read that quote because I just thought it was so beautiful, which is when you, and I'm paraphrasing, but the idea of loving yourself is an act of decolonization and resistance. And I thought that was extremely powerful. And this makes me think of your next book, because I do wonder, I don't know how much it, you know, inspired by your son, but it's very much now your next book coming out next year called Breakable. And that focuses on Indigenous men and kind of breaking these narratives of masculinity. What inspired that? And, you know, what are the conversations we all need to be having about gender equality? Because, you know, that often in our work comes up a lot when people say, what about men? And, you know, we're similar. We're the Canadian Women's Foundation. We work, focus on women, girls, and gender diverse people, but we are aware that everyone needs to be having a conversation about gender equality. So can you talk a bit about your next book?
Yeah. So the idea for this came from an interview that I did. I was kind of at the tail end of my career. I think this might have been at the beginning of 2023. It might have been at around 2022 as well. But I was doing some stories on the toxic drug overdose crisis. And of course, you know, I always wanted to focus on Indigenous perspectives on that. And some statistics were coming out that were focused on Indigenous people, but that were also focused on the numbers from BC. And anywhere that I looked, whether it was Indigenous, whether it was BC, whether it was the United States, whether it was North America, the statistics for men's, the numbers for men who had died through toxic drugs was anywhere from 72 to 89%. That's how much men account for the toxic drug overdose crisis. And that is a huge number. You cannot ignore that number. It's not 51%. It's not, you know, 69%. It's like in some cases, almost 90%. And that like really shook me. And so I'd asked this guy, this non-Indigenous guy, Guy Felicella. He's overdosed 7 times and been brought back to life that many times in his life. And now he works in harm reduction. And I felt like no one was talking about this. And I felt that was really odd that no one was like, what is going on? And the way that it was framed in Indigenous communities was like, women are overrepresented in terms of, you know, we only make up 5% of the population in Canada, but yet we're represented in the toxic overdose crisis by, I can't remember the statistic for that, but it was just like, what about the men? Like that's, you can't just ignore that. Like, how come nobody's talking about this? And so I asked Guy about that. And he was like, I was like, why do you think this is? And he's like, well, I think it's because men are told that they can't express themselves. And I was totally taken aback. And so I said, because men can't express their emotions. And he's like, anything. Men can't express themselves at all. That's what they're told. And so I was like, this needs to be, we need to crack open this and see what's there. And so I started doing research, and not only do men overrepresented in that crisis, but they're also overrepresented by a huge percentage in suicides across North, and very high as well, like same thing, 70, 80, 90%. And same thing as violence. So we talk a lot about violence against women and girls. And we know that men are by large, the large percentage of the perpetrators, but they're also the largest amount of the victims. And then there's been some research that is slowly being done that says it's, you know, it's not people are like, oh, but that's different. It's gang or it's street or, and I'm like, but why is that not as important for one? Why aren't we talking about that? And two, there's some new research that's coming out that shows that a lot of men are experiencing violence in the home. They're just not talking about it. And it's by other men, by family members. And then I found out 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused, but we don't hear about that either. And so it just, my heart just started like, you know, raising a son, but also just the number of men who had treated me really poorly in my life and having a lot of anger, having a lot of confusion, you know, from my dad to boyfriends, partners, and feeling betrayed, feeling abandoned, feeling abused and hurt. And now it sort of moved into not like that should be forgiven because of this new information, but forgiveness is a personal journey. But I had a lot more compassion. And that's sort of like what I just told you is sort of like the nuts and bolts of my book is just constantly grappling with compassion, but accountability, but compassion, but accountability. And where do we land with that personally, collectively, as a community? How do we hold Indigenous men accountable when they've had this horrific atrocity forced upon them for generations? This is a different kind of trauma. It's complex. And not easy always to figure out how to include certain individuals in our communities when they're unsafe. So all of these questions I'm sort of answering, or I was answering. So that's sort of a long way to say that's how I came to the genesis of Breakable, and kind of where I'm at still working out these questions.
What right now is giving you hope, and what right now is motivating you to keep doing the work that you do?
I have like so much hope. It's kind of like I don't know where to begin. I mean, I guess I'm staring at all my books, and I can't remember her name. I'll have to find it later. Maybe you can include it in the show notes, but Shailena Knight. Does that ring a bell? Shailena Knight. She said, books are our allies. Whatever we're going through, books can be like our friends, our allies, our kin, and books just give me so much hope. And even the book I'm reading right now by Paul Kivel, and he's sort of the man who came up with this notion of the man box. Even him, like he's this man, it's from 1992, which my partner's like, that's not long ago. And I'm like, but it kind of is. It's just the way he's talking about how he walked through the world. But he's just openly talking about how he walks through the world as a white man, super honest. It's kind of like jarring, actually. But I'm like, that's brave. That's vulnerable. That's creating opportunities for people to reflect and see who they are, you know, unfiltered. And I'm reading another book at the same time called Big Magic. It's by Elizabeth Gilbert, the same woman who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. And it's about something similar to what I just said. It's all about making space for fear in our lives. But she's talking about it with the analogy of a car. And so she's like, my creativity, my inspiration, they get to drive, they get to turn on the radio, they get to fumble with the temperature. Fear, you can totally be here in the car. You can be part of the journey, but you don't get to touch the temperature. You never get to drive, but you get to hang out. And she's talking about coexisting with fear and creativity. And oh man, yeah, I could just go on and on and on. Scarlett Lewis, if people ever want to look at her, this is a little bit dark, but she gives me so much freaking hope. Her son, her 6-year-old, died in the Sandy Hook massacre, 6 years old. And she's created this foundation where she talks about helping offenders. She works in prisons now, helping offenders to regulate their systems and to hold space for their fear, but to hold compassion in their hearts for people who may be struggling. Scarlett Lewis gives me so much hope, and people should totally look her up. She's a white woman who experienced an incredibly horrific tragedy, but took that and created something so powerful out of it. And it's all about, how do we love more? And she says the highest form of love is attention. What we give our attention to, it's where our energy flows, you know, our kids, that's the highest form of love. And that kind of shook me. I was like, whoa. Right. But yeah, so many things. I could go on and on and on, which gives me myself hope that I have this many things to be hopeful about. but yeah, people should look up Shaylee Knight, amazing author. Tierra Cash, an incredible woman who works in meditation and politics. I'm probably not encapsulating that. And Scarlett Lewis, who is also a leader in love, really.
Thank you for helping shift the story on safety, leadership, justice, power, and rights. You can visit CanadianWomen.org today to learn more and stay connected. We believe everyone should be able to exist without fear of harassment or abuse. You can help make that a reality. Text SAFE, S-A-F-E, to 20222 to give $10 and support women, girls, and gender diverse people throughout Canada. Small actions can lead to big changes. We appreciate your support.